You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
Hey everybody, Tim McMaster here, taking you around the National League East with MLB.com Extras. We start off this week with the team in first place in the East. That's with MLB.com Nationals reporter Bill Latson. Yeah, Harper is certainly red hot, named co-National League Player of the Week along with Nolan Arenado for last week. He actually homered in his last four games of the week. He also put himself in some rare company as far as Philadelphia goes. He homered in six straight games in Philadelphia now. Ernie Banks, the only other visiting player to do that, Bill. I know he was the National League MVP a year ago, and he was unbelievable all year long. Were there times last year when he was as locked in as he is right now?
You know, I think it's even as far as, you know, what Harper's done. I mean, the amazing part to me is that he doesn't strike out the way he used to. And the guy's on-base percentage is extremely high. I mean, it's almost to the point where you're almost comparing him to Barry Bonds now. And I got to tell you, it's fun to watch. The thing that's shocking me the most is that pitchers are pitching to him. And it's obvious to me that since the offense is inconsistent, I think they shouldn't even pitch to, you know, Bryce Harper. You know, let Ryan Zimmerman, Jason Worth, let them beat them. And, you know, I think they'll be okay. I mean, I'm surprised they're pitching with Bryce Harper, to be honest with you, after what he's done, especially the Phillies pitchers. I don't know what the thinking is there.
Yeah, you'd think he'd be getting the Bonds treatment at this point, where anytime there's a base open, just put this guy on base. Bill, we talked a couple weeks ago, I think, about being a little concerned about Gio Gonzalez when he would finally get his start and if he'd be consistent and around the strike zone, because in the past he's had command issues and he hadn't made that start yet. And apparently there was nothing to worry about, because Gio has come out and been fantastic. Six scoreless innings last time out, first time out, and two great starts from Gio. What have you seen as far as the command and how he's been able to put together back-to-back great starts?
Well, I think there was worry during spring training because he had walked 11 batters in eight innings, and I think that was a problem, and that's why he became the fifth starter. And all of a sudden, you know, he had to wait 2 weeks after the season started, to, you know, to get his time to throw on the mound. And I think he figured something out. I think he knew he had to throw strikes, and also pick up the pace a little bit as he was pitching. So that was the main thing Mike Maddux told him to do, just pick up the pace, which he has done. And he hasn't given up a run yet, and that's good to see. I'm seeing the old Gio from 2012.
Yeah, back when he was a front-of-the-line type guy. If he can do that, look out as far as this Nationals team goes. We were talking about Harper and how good he's been and how clutch he's been, and he was clutch on Sunday, top of the 10th inning, comes through with a homer to put the team up. But then they lose it in the bottom of the 10th. Jonathan Papelbon, first blown save of the year. He had been 5-for-5 despite a few white-knuckle efforts. A lot, Bill, has been made of his velocity decreasing over the last few years. Any concern from you about Papelbon long-term this season, or do you think, despite the lower velocity, he's still going to be able to get it done?
I think he's going to get it done. I mean, my concern was, you know, he's getting up there in age now. He's 35 years old, 36. And I'm just telling you, it was the age factor. I was not worried about how he was going to get along with Bryce Harper. It was just a matter of, you know, how long, you know, what does he have left? And so far, I think he's done a great job. And just the one game against the Philadelphia Phillies, I think everything is going to be fine with Papelbon. He's the last of my worries. I think he's going to be fine. I don't think it matters with him, his velocity. I think it's going to be a matter of location. And so far, the location has been there.
Yeah, and that's something that he's always had, that he's really been strong with throughout his career, is pinpoint control with that fastball. Well, Bill, I know you had a chance this week to sit down with Joe Ross a little bit and talk to him. So we're going to take a listen to some of that interview to close out the podcast.
You got it.
What have you learned from last year? You came up surprisingly early last year, and you did well until the end. But what did you learn from last year?
I mean, just kind of trust your stuff, you know. Don't try and do too much. You know, now that I got called up, you know, don't try and change how I pitch. Just go out and just try and execute pitches. And I think, you know, staying within myself is the best advice to give. You know, just trust the process and trust everything you're doing, and you'll be all right.
Not only are you having a good year on the mound, but you can hit too. Talk about your hitting. Where did you learn how to hit?
I was always a position player growing up, so, you know, I always liked hitting. I still enjoy hitting. I wouldn't say that I'm a good hitter still. I just don't look as terrible, you know, as some guys. But, you know, I take pride in trying to be able to hit. And I've hit, you know, I couldn't tell you how many times with my dad, you know, growing up, that's all we do, and then kind of transformed into being a pitcher. So I think that kind of paid off in the long run. But, yeah, you know, still working. We have a little competition between all of us. So whenever I can, you know, get a base hit and help myself out, you know, I'll take it.
Dusty Baker thinks you're a good hitter. He bragged about how you had a 10-pitch at-bat in the first inning in Friday's game, and that was amazing.
Yeah, I mean, I was just – I think I went 0-2, you know, within the first two pitches. And then after that, it's just kind of fighting pitches off. At that point, it's kind of just trying to put the ball in play and maybe get a hit, make an error, force contact. But, yeah, I mean, fouled off some pitches and then got a fastball just kind of snuck it down the third baseline for a double. Yeah, you know, it was fun at bat. It was funny, you know, getting that before I even got back out on the mound. So, you know, those runs early in the game were pretty big.
You have a great rotation, 1.98 going into Sunday's action. How amazing is this rotation?
I mean, we've been really good. I expected, you know, even spring training from the start that, you know, we would pitch and do really well. I think it's just guys have been, you know, staying healthy and sticking to their game plans and attacking hitters. You know, we've been lucky enough to have, I don't know how many runs per game, but it's, you know, the run support has been there and it's been early. And I think that kind of gives us a little bit extra confidence, you know, going out there and pitching you know, getting outs.
First year under Dusty Baker, the team is doing very well. What's it like to work for Dusty Baker?
He's awesome. He definitely keeps it loose. You know, he knows how to relate to the players, and everyone gets along with him pretty well. But he also knows what he's talking about. So, you know, it's fun in games, but then when it's time, you know, to go to work, you know, it's time to get down to business. I think he does a good job balancing both. I think we've responded well as a team to him, you know, just with the first 10 or so games of the year. And, you know, hopefully I think that should continue throughout the rest of the year and hopefully translate into a good season for us.
You also have a brother in this league, an older brother, and he's doing well himself. Talk about how much Tyson Ross has helped you.
He's helped me a lot. He, you know, growing up was always that one to kind of stay on top of me, you know, make sure I'm, you know, keeping up with all my stuff. You know, my dad was always my coach growing up, you know, all the way up until high school. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, Tyson kind of took over and in a way that I see how he works in the off season, and I see everything that he does. And, you know, before my first year of pro ball, like, I feel like I kind of had in my own head what it should look like, what I should be doing,
right,
something like that. So he kind of, you know, paved the way for me, you know. And then, you know, it's been fun almost competing with him. I wouldn't say, you know, we have a competition going on, but, mm-hmm, you know, he's always been doing well, and I try and keep up, and I try and, you know, do a little bit better than he does, yeah, you know, game after game. So I think it's been good that, you know, we push each other a little bit, and it's a little, you know, friendly competition, I guess.
Todd, the Phillies they played well at times early this season, but they ran into Noah Syndergaard on Monday night, which is – it's been bad news for anybody this season. But what has been so good about him, and how did the Phillies fail to attack him properly, I guess?
Well, it was fun watching him pitch last night. 100 miles an hour, 101 mile an hour, and then he'd like come back at you with like a 94 mile an hour slider. And nobody really has a chance against this guy right now. It seems like every scout right now is going, he's my NL Cy Young pick. He's my favorite. Quite frankly, I think any team is going to have trouble with him, obviously, but I think especially a team like the Phillies, they're just outgunned right now against a guy like Syndergaard. And really, if you look at their numbers, they've been kind of outgunned by pretty much everybody they face this season. They're just not a team that is going to score a lot of runs. In fact, I think through 14 games, the Phillies have failed to pick up 10 hits in a single game, which is a franchise record. And I think it's also the longest drought to start a season since the Astros in 2014. So, Syndergaard is a really, really tough task against this group.
You mentioned the struggles offensively, and the one position that really kind of stands out is left field, which has been a bit of a black hole for this team. 248 combined OPS heading into the game on Monday. So they option Cedric Hunter to AAA. They bring up David Lowe. He's a guy that obviously has some major league experience. They just looking for a spark at this point?
Yeah, I think, honestly, I don't think they're looking at David Lowe as a savior by any means. I think they're just looking for somebody that can get a hit every once in a while. They just were not getting a hit every once in a while with Cedric Hunter and Tyler Goodell. Darren Ruff has played a little bit of left field over the past few days, but they just weren't getting anything. And like you mentioned, 248 OPS. That's not on base percentage. That's OPS, which is really, really, really bad. And they just need to get something going. That left field spot has been a problem. You know, right field, Peter Borges has been struggling quite a bit. In fact, I think their OPS amongst Phillies right fielders also ranked last in baseball. So those corner outfield spots have been a big problem for them.
And then the other issue is leadoff, right? I mean, not just those positions, but then just somebody to kind of fill that role at the top of the order.
Yeah, Pete McCannon has been trying different people. But basically, he's been going with either Freddie Galvis or Cesar Hernandez. Hernandez makes a lot of sense because he gets on base a lot. He's got some speed, but he, for whatever reason, he's not comfortable hitting leadoff. You look at his career splits, hitting first and hitting second, it's night and day. He's a very, very good number two hitter, not a very good number one hitter. And so Pete has gone with Freddie Galvis. Now, you look at Freddie Galvis's career numbers, just not a very good on-base guy. You know, a career on-base percentage, I believe, under 300. He just has not shown that knack of getting on base consistently throughout his career. Personally, if I were Pete, and I've asked him about this, he's probably sick of me asking him about it. I've been asking him a lot the last several days about Odubel Herrera leading off. You know, Odubel Herrera right now leads Major League Baseball in pitches per plate appearance. I think the number is like 5.18, and he's second in Major League Baseball with 13 walks. So he's getting on base a lot, and he seems to really enjoy working a pitcher and working that walk. And Pete's argument is, you know, he is one of my best pure hitters. I don't want him to hit first. My argument would be, you know, you'd much rather have Odubel Herrera getting more at-bats throughout the course of the game than Freddie Galvis. And this is a team who, in years past, one of their better hitters was Jimmy Rollins, and he hit first with great success and really got that offense going. And I really think Herrera could do the same. But Pete obviously disagrees with me.
Galvis, you mentioned, not a perfect fit as far as leadoff, but he was the perfect fit in extra innings on Sunday and a huge win for the Phillies against the Nationals after it looked like they had let it go with Bryce Harper homering in the top of the 10th. They rally back, and they do it against Jonathan Papelbon in Philadelphia. Did that make it – I know it doesn't matter to the players, but as far as the atmosphere and the fans at that game – did they kind of take a little extra pleasure in that game having beaten Papelbon in the 10th?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. There's no doubt that Papelbon was not one of the most well-liked, well-received players in Philly's history, certainly not in the last 10 years. In fact, I joked about it with Papelbon last year when he returned for the first time against the Nationals. I said, you're probably not going to be invited to any alumni days or be erected on the onto the Wall of Fame. And he didn't disagree with me. So certainly fans enjoyed beating him. And you know what? It's fun having like the good guy versus the bad guy. And in this case, of course, the Phillies fans think the Phillies are the good guys and Papelbon is the bad guy. And Papelbon relishes that role. In fact, after the game, he said, you know what? Hey, I'm upset that I blew the save, but guess what? We're walking out of here. We won 2 out of 3 and we're still in first place. In other words, I'm probably going to be in the postseason this year, and the Phillies are going to be rebuilding. So Papelbon kind of knows what to say to kind of increase that role of that villain role. And for that reason, I think when the Phillies do get to Papelbon, and they have gotten to Papelbon ever since the trade with D.C., they've really, really enjoyed it.
Joe, it was a tough weekend for the Marlins, getting swept by the Braves, who had come in to that series 0-9, but a nice bounce back on Monday. This team kind of needed a lift, and when you need a lift, you need your big players to step up, and they certainly got that from both Jose Fernandez on the hill and Giancarlo Stanton at the plate. Fernandez struggled a little bit early, but kind of found his gear later in the game, and then Stanton homers in the game. Let's start with Fernandez on Monday night. He had the bases loaded in the second inning. He got out of it with a big strikeout, and he showed that emotion that I think fans love to see. Did he talk at all about that, getting through that, and how it helped him settle down later in the game?
Yeah, I mean, Jose is highly energized and highly, you know, motivated every time he's on the mound, maybe a little too much, though. And, you know, he's going to have to get, you know, kind of corral it a bit. You know, you can't pitch, you know, just too much, you know, with the enthusiasm and the energy overflowing where, you know, he gets the ball and he flips it up in the air or he kind of rolls his eyes and has the back of his face. And, you know, guys can get on base against him. He's got to kind of lock it in, and we certainly saw him capable of doing it. And, you know, they ran his pitch count up, and that's what kind of happened in all three of his starts. He's had, you know, the strikeout numbers have been there, but the inning pitch haven't been there. Now, it was good to get him through six. He's able to recover, and I think as he gets, you know, goes along and kind of figures out how to get quicker outs, and this is what we were talking about in spring training, about trying to maybe pitch down in velocity a little bit to kind of get, you know, that fastball command and get guys out at 93 to 95 rather than living at 97, 98, 99, because, you know, and then nasty breaking balls to get a lot of strikeouts, but a lot of 7-8 pitch at-bats in the process and short outings, and then you get that danger zone of overtaxing and stressful innings, which, you know, is going to be crucial to the longevity of this pitcher. So I think Jose is still in the process of looking for that balance, and without, you know, fastball command, which he lacked early, you know, he's going to have high pitch counts. But the encouraging thing is, even when he's off, he had, a no-hitter through three or four, and, you know, he walked a high number, but he's able to get out of it because he is such a good strikeout pitcher. He could get out of messes that way. But real encouraging to get him going, and as you noted, get Stanton. You know, to have those two producing, those are their key guys. And if they're going to go where they want to go, those guys are going to have to lead the way. So last night was something the Marlins fans were looking a long time to see.
Yeah, you want your ace to give you more than six at some point. He's got to be the guy that kind of saves that bullpen over the course of a season. As far as Stanton goes, what has been – has he had any reasoning behind the slow start? Has it just been getting the timing right or getting comfortable at the plate in the regular season?
Well, there's a combination of things. For one, he hasn't played a ton of baseball because, you know, he played, 45 games last year, and, you know, he's still getting into, you know, being pitched to and kind of getting back into a flow. You know, he missed so much time. My observation is he looked like he's been just trying to hit home runs to left on every pitch, you know, just, and not in the Atlanta series. He struck out, seven times, I think, in 13 at bats. And, you know, was just seeming the ball come out of the hand and he's swinging. You know, some of the most awful at bats I've ever seen him take. And it looks like he hasn't recognized the other side of the field exists. And the home run was to center, which was a sign he's staying back on the ball and not just looking to yank everything over the left field wall. And then an RBI single to right field as well. So Stanton, like a lot of great hitters, when they start taking what's given and not trying to do too much, the power's certainly there. We all know that. And a more effective Stanton is someone that is seeing the ball better, using all fields, and then when they make a mistake, just doing what he can do and drive the ball a long way.
Speaking of using the whole field, Joe, you wrote an article this week about Justin Bour, and he's a guy who's been facing kind of the heavy shift in baseball these days with all the shifts going on, and it seems like he's really figured out how to use the whole field and beat that shift, and that's only going to open things up for him as the season goes on.
Yeah, he's going to be crucial, especially if they're going to stay with this lineup with Ward hitting behind Stanton now instead of Prado there. And, you know, they're going to need a lot because, you know, being a left-handed hitter, you know, Ward gets that lefty shift. And six of his first nine hits this year have been to the opposite field. And even the other day against Atlanta, he had a really good, you know, ball that was hitting at a gap. It was a sacrifice fly, but if, you know, it was a really good defensive play, too. And he was, you know, basically a couple of feet away from extra bases and clearing the bases. And the Marlins may have won the game from Miami right there with that line drive sacrifice fly that he got. He had a few balls hit that way. If teams are going to overshift him and he has the opportunity to punch the ball to the left side, he's going to do it. And, you know, he never really felt that he's, you know, strictly a pull type hitter, but, you know, being a left-handed hitter, they get that exaggerated shift a lot. And, you know, he also benefited because once they played him more straight up and he got a single up the middle, which, you know, with the shift, that probably would have been the shortstop standing there on the first base side of second base. So he's a guy that, you know, still hasn't shown he can hit left-handed pitching, but, you know, if they're going to shift him, he's, you know, he's open to even dropping a bunt that way as well.
Kyle Barraclough recalled over the weekend, and on Saturday struck out the side in the seventh inning. I guess he also has a new pitch. He's added a changeup to the arsenal. What does the team hope his role will be as long as he's up with the big club?
Well, that more traditional power arm, upper 90s fastball, you know, that they don't have since Carter Capps got hurt. And, you know, he's a guy who came into spring training, probably was going to make the team, but his control was just all over the place in spring training. I think it was 8 walks, 8 strikeouts in like 4 or 5 innings. So, you know, then he went down to the minors, and he might be up here a little prematurely, but he was heading in that right direction of throwing a lot more strikes. And, you know, his first two innings since he's been called up, he's had, 5 or so strikeouts, but both innings well over 20 pitches. And, you know, that he's still walking guys. He threw a wild pitch last night as well, but he's another guy that has the ability to strike you out to get out of his own mess. But here's a guy with a wipeout slider. If he can command his fastball, it's going to be crucial. And if he can, he could be that really good seventh inning guy and getting it to David Phelps, who clearly has established himself as the eighth inning guy. And Mattingly said he's hoping to avoid multiple innings with Phelps right now. So, you know, Barraclough and Brian Morris seem to be that sixth, seventh inning guys to get you to Phelps and then bridging you to A.J. Ramos to close.
Mark, an 0-9 start, but here come the Braves. A big sweep in Miami over a team that a lot of people think could surprise this season in the Marlins. What changed between 0-9 and suddenly a 3-0 weekend?
Well, you know, this team, it was able to preserve some leads. It did not make the defensive mistakes, the bullpen did not show some of its wear and tear or some of its weaknesses. Let's just, you know, put it how it is during this weekend series. And in fact, the bullpen was a strength. The defense was better. And what we saw was Nick Markakis continued to pace that offense, and he was up there at the top of the lineup throughout the weekend. They moved Malik Smith down, which made perfect sense. I think what we've seen from Malik Smith this first week is, you know, why the Braves really wanted him to stay in the minor league level until June. He came up with the big hit yesterday, but at the same time, I don't think he's quite ready. Does it hurt him to learn on the fly here? Not really, but at the same time, I think it could benefit him to spend a little bit more time down at the minor league level. You can see he's close, but there are some instances where, whether it's plate recognition, just where he could benefit from a little bit more seasoning. They got pretty good starting pitching. They didn't necessarily, well, you know, Williams Perez, I think he may be, you know, that they're in a position where if Mike Foltynewicz pitches well here this next start here for Gwinnett, they could bring Foltynewicz up to the rotation next week. So, you know, maybe Williams Perez is the guy that falls out of the rotation first. But this is a, you know, I think if you look back, that 0-9 start, they have really, I mean, at the end of the day, They had a chance to win at least four of those, maybe five of those games. They were also they faced within four of those nine games Strasburg and Scherzer. So, and then the other three games were against the Cardinals pitching staff, or at least three of the other games were against the Cardinals pitching staff. So, you know, it wasn't an easy first stretch. They took advantage of what they were given down there in Miami, and now they head back home with a little bit of momentum.
You mentioned Malik Smith, and what a wild first week in the major leagues for a guy to, you know, his first game, he gets his first hit, then he gets hit in the face with his helmet. He leaves bloodied, the blood trickling down his face, and then he ends the week with a game-winning hit in extra innings, but it's in a game in which, until that point, he had really looked kind of lost at the plate. But that's baseball, I guess, is what we say.
You know, when you even add to that,
yeah.
Tim, he gets the game-winning hit, and after, instead of everyone coming over and patting him on the back, Terry Pendleton, you know, he gives him a good didn't read him the riot act, but he had some things to say to him because he got caught in between first and second there, and the Braves missed an opportunity maybe to drive in another insurance run or two there after he delivered that game when he hit. So that's those are little things that, you know, hey, look, maybe it's better that he makes a mistake here instead of the minor league level, because maybe down the minors at speed, he gets a run down and he gets back to first base. In other words, it's good to learn up here, but at the same time, I think what we have seen from Alex is that there are still some parts of his game that need some seasoning.
Yeah, still some maturing to do. You mentioned that the bullpen was good. Jason Grilli on Saturday picks up his first save since rupturing his Achilles last season. A bit of a white knuckler, and then obviously he didn't pitch as well Sunday. But overall, how nice is it to see a guy like Jason Grilli, a guy who I know is a good guy, to have to battle back the way he did, to see him out there succeeding again?
No, it is good to see anybody come back from that kind of injury, especially at his age. You know, his stuff is not quite what it was the previous couple of years. You still see him hobbling around. The fastball's not quite what it had been in the past. It has stayed rather consistent the last few outings around that 91.8 average fastball velocity. And last year, you know, you saw him up there a little bit higher than 93, 94. I think that, you know, it is very important for Grilli to remain healthy and give the Braves some depth there in the middle innings. It's not, you know, as you saw, he can fill in to be the closer when Vizcaino is not available. Eat up, you know, either hand the ball to Vizcaino or at the same time step in and serve as a closer, a guy who knows how to get those outs. And I think that's what we saw on Saturday night. You know, his last at bat against Stanton, that just showed you who Jason really is. He fools him back, fools him with two sliders there, gets him to swing at two pitches out of the zone, and then just challenges him with that high fastball to end the game. It's good to see him there. I think that he will tell you, you know, he even told Freddie Gonzalez earlier in the week, he worked a sixth inning earlier in the week because he just wasn't feeling good. So it's still a work in progress with him as he comes back from this significant injury at this age. But, like I said, that the Braves really need him to add some depth to that bullpen.
Over the course of a season, you need guys to step up and be team players to be a successful team. And how about Matt Whistler stepping up and coming out of the bullpen to close things out on Sunday when this team really needed an inning from him?
Yeah, you think about that. You go back to Thursday, and they're heading towards 0-9. Vizcaino had not gotten a lot of work. He gets 16 pitches that game just to get some work. The next night he's needed for four out save, he throws 35 pitches, then all of a sudden he's unavailable for Saturday or Sunday. They had a 4-0 lead in the first inning, ends up giving up that lead, and then Jason Grilli gives up the game tying 2-out single to Ichiro there in the ninth. And the Braves went into yesterday knowing they didn't have Vizcaino or Chris Winthrop. So they basically had five available relievers to get over the once. Just seen left with one out in the sixth inning. They had to get through the rest of the game that way. They had two lefties that combined to face three batters and get just one out. So now all of a sudden you're looking at basically three relievers and And they were hoping that Grilly could have got that last out. When he did not, Whistler comes in and he gets a six-pitch, throws a six-pitch perfect 10th inning to record the save. And I really don't think this throws him off schedule all that much for the rest, for this week, because he was scheduled to start Tuesday. Now you just back him up one day. You bring Julio Teheran back on Tuesday to start on regular rest, and you know everything else falls into place. Yes, it would have been significant had Whistler been forced to throw multiple innings. I my thinking is what they probably would have done is reacted and said, okay, well, instead of Mike Fulton, they would start for Gwinnett tonight. He would have started one of the next two nights here for Atlanta. So, you know, the key is the front office has told Freddie, hey, look, go out there and try to win every game possible. There really weren't any other choices yesterday. And some of the fans there, you jeopardized Matt Whistler's future. Well, really, I think the work he did was probably less taxing than what he would have done had he completed the side session he was going to throw no matter what yesterday. So, everything worked out for Freddie there yesterday, and like I said, you can't predict that Vizcaino is going to have to throw 35 pitches the night after you used him just to get some work in, but that's the way this season evolves, and it's one of the hardest parts about this game. You know, you ask any managers managing that bullpen, especially when you have a bullpen where you don't necessarily have more than a couple good options.
On Sunday, when we talk about this Mets team, we saw a different Steven Matz. Seven scoreless innings, three hits. He strikes out nine along the way. That was a career high. His ERA drops 30 runs from his first game. That's just kind of the fun you can have early in a season. But what was different from what you saw between Steven Matz Sunday and his first start of the year?
Well, the biggest thing, and pitching coach Dan Worthen said this as well, was that he really started mixing up his pitches, which he wasn't doing as well against the Marlins. And, you know, look, Steven Matz was missing his spots against the Marlins for sure. The Marlins hit some pretty good pitches in that game also for sure. But once you start pitching the way that Matz did in Cleveland, it's just really hard to hit a guy with that kind of stuff when you're pitching and not necessarily throwing. And what I mean by that was not at the start of the game. He was doing well from the start, but got into a couple of jams. And then he gave up a leadoff double in the fourth inning. And from that point forward, from that point until he left the game, he threw more breaking pitches than fastballs. Now, that might be a little extreme. You don't necessarily need to do that, go to that extent every time out. But what it does is it obviously puts that doubt in the back of a hitter's mind that you don't know what you're going to get. You can't look in a fastball count and say, I'm not going to get a curveball here. Very similar to how Noah Syndergaard was able to progress so quickly. You know, when Noah Syndergaard came up, people forget that this guy really was just kind of a thrower and was trying to fire 100 miles an hour past everyone, and it didn't work right away. And it wasn't until he clicked into that second gear where he started throwing his off-speed in fastball counts, and he started being able to command that off-speed stuff, getting comfortable with it, trusting it, that he really turned into the pitcher that we see right now. You know, Steven Matz's stuff isn't quite as good as Noah Syndergaard's, because you could maybe say that no one in baseball's is, but his stuff is still pretty close to the top of the chart. So if he can learn that same lesson, he has a chance to turn things around, as you saw over the weekend, real quickly.
Yeah, and Matt's start on Sunday really gave the Mets a lift after a tough outing from Matt Harvey Saturday, although not really tough in the sense that he was perfect through four innings. But then it kind of all unraveled for him. Now 0-3 on the season, and it seems like at least Saturday, part of what the issue was Harvey pitching from the stretch. What exactly is going on there when he's got base runners?
Yeah, that's a very specific mechanical tweak that both Worthen mentioned and the Indians themselves mentioned after the game, saying that he was just essentially a different pitcher. Worthen described it as his back leg collapsing, which is kind of pitcher speak for saying that he's just not getting the same oomph on the ball that he does as a windup. It's something that has been on and off an issue for Matt throughout his entire career, but it certainly came back to bite him against the Indians. So that's something the Mets are going to work on and hope it fixes the problems, because frankly, while Matt Harvey's stuff certainly still looks good, it's not quite what we're used to seeing from him. Instead of kind of sitting 95 miles an hour and being able to bump it up to 98, 99 on occasion when he needs it, Matt Harvey's been more like 92, 93 so far this year. And maybe, you know, you'll throw in a couple 94s and an occasional 95 in there. So it's still really hard, but it's not that elite stuff that we're used to seeing from Matt Harvey. Even after he came back from his surgery last year, he was back up 95, 96. I believe he was averaging over 96 miles an hour with his fastball, no problem last year. So that, to me, is a little bit of a concern beyond the mechanical stuff. And we'll see. Maybe it's just an early April thing, and once, you know, we start warming up here and everyone gets in a normal routine, normal schedule, the velocity will come all the way back. Again, we're not talking about huge differences here, but enough to raise an eyebrow and something to keep an eye on as we go forward into the summer.
The offense seems to kind of be starting to come around, and one big factor over the weekend was Conforto going to the three hole and really having a fantastic series, 5-for-12 overall. That's a spot where obviously he's comfortable. I mean, he's been that kind of hitter throughout his career, but not at the big league level yet. How often is he going to find himself batting third for the Mets this season?
He just kind of looks like a three hitter, doesn't he?
Yeah.
Going up there. I mean, he's got that elite contact skill. He's got a lot of power. He spreads the field. He hits it everywhere. So you're going to continue to see him out there. Terry Collins has essentially said this guy's going to be in the three hole now against right-handed pitchers for as long as he's producing. Now, things can change quickly around here, and a couple of 0-for-4s could certainly put him back down number 6 in the lineup where he had been. Even something as simple as Lucas getting on one of his patented hot stretches might change the equation a little bit. But the Mets like what they see from this kid, and he's certainly not been intimidated by anything the team has thrown at him, whether it's coming straight from Double-A to the big leagues last summer, whether it's sticking around for the pennant chase, really when we all thought Conforto was going to be here for a week or two and then go back down to the minors, and then getting thrust into this three-hole position in a place that could be intimidating for a lot of young hitters, even the best young hitters. All of a sudden you're hitting between David Wright and Yoenis Cespedes, and you're saying, geez, I was in college less than 2 years ago. I mean, do I really belong? Does my bat really belong here? Well, Michael Conforto says he's never had any of those doubts, and frankly, I believe him, because you just see the cool, sort of calm, collected demeanor that this guy's got both on and off the field, and with the talent that he also possesses, it's really no surprise that he's seen success. The next step for him, obviously, is going to be proving he can hit lefties, which is a little bit of a chicken and an egg scenario, because the Mets have been hesitant to play him against left-handed starters. And they've only seen one so far this year, so we'll see how that plays out deeper into the summer. But, you know, if Michael Conforto can do that and become that all-around hitter that's playing in 150-plus games, producing the numbers that he's capable of producing, all of a sudden the offense is going to start to revolve around him.
Yeah, he can certainly be a key cog in that offense and what they want to do. I wanted to check in with you about Jacob deGrom. Obviously, it's been a little bit of an extended time away now, complications with the new baby that seems to be some good news there. And I know he threw a bullpen session on Sunday. What's the earliest we could see deGrom back on the mound for the Mets?
Well, he was originally scheduled to pitch Tuesday in Philadelphia. That's not going to happen. He's on the family emergency list, tending to the baby, who as of Sunday night was doing much better. So it's great news for DeGrom, his wife Stacy, the whole family that have obviously been going through a very tough time that, you know, few of us could even imagine. But in the interim, from a baseball perspective, his lat muscle is much better, according to the Mets, according to Terry Collins. DeGrom has been driving back and forth to Port St. Lucie to throw these bullpen sessions. He's done two of them now. The last of them was 40 pitches. So assuming all is well with the baby and he's able to come off that family emergency list in time for his start after this one, which I believe would be the end of or it would be next Monday, I believe. As long as he's able to do that, physically there shouldn't be any issues. The lat muscle seems like it's healed. You know, if anything, missing this start was kind of a blessing in disguise for DeGrom, because those injuries can be tricky. It's a big muscle. We saw it with Steven Matz last year, coming back too soon from an identical injury and winding up hurting it worse and missing 2 months. So for all intents and purposes, I think you're looking at penciling Jacob DeGrom in for his next start after this week, and the Mets will go from there. They could certainly use him with a lot of their other starters sort of underperforming to this point this season.